Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to season 3 of Queer I Am, the podcast, live and unscripted. I am so excited to share this with you. The podcast has been recorded over 8 weeks in front of a live audience at Arco Baleno, an inclusive queer space in the heart of Kemp Town, Brighton. I am so proud to be partnering with Arco Baleno and cannot thank Luciana, Nick and the whole team there enough for their support and generosity in the making of this season of the podcast. If you haven't been there before, please check it out. Not only do they have an incredible Maltese menu for you to explore, but they also have a range of cocktails, drinks, and a regular schedule of entertainment for you to enjoy. The podcast is also being supported by their production company, Across Rainbows Productions, and film for YouTube. So if you didn't get to come to one of the live shows, you can find these videos at your leisure on the Across Rainbows YouTube channel. Make sure you subscribe, give the videos a like, and leave any comments you may have. We also had several authors participate in the shows, and Kemp Town Bookshop were on hand to sell signed books by the authors. You can check out this beautiful bookshop in the heart of Brighton, but make sure you take your credit card because you will not leave empty-handed. The shows feature a panel of guests where we'll be talking all things queer, and an audience Q&A too, an opportunity for everyone to get involved in the conversation. In this episode, we'll be discussing understanding and acknowledging queer history. The show features actress, author and philanthropist Jill Nalder, writer and podcast producer Adam Smith, performer Wayne Douglas and author Darren Kay. I hope you enjoy the show. So whatever you're up to, this is your time to settle down, relax and enjoy the podcast. Welcome to Queer I Am. Hello, everyone. Thank you all so much for coming this evening. It's so lovely to see such a lovely turnout and an incredible panel of guests to talk about queer history. I'm so excited about this conversation. So welcome. And we're talking queer history today. We're going to have a really open conversation. It's a safe space. And I've got questions here. But to be honest, after some of the conversations we've already had tonight, I kind of feel like I'm going to let them just do their thing and just kind of go with it. But we'll be recording for about an hour or so. We'll then have an interval and we'll be selling some books. And I'll then become a book salesperson as well, which is very fun because I get to use the chip and pin machine, which is it's a small thing, but, you know, it's quite fun to use. And and then afterwards, we'll be coming back for an audience Q&A. So if anyone has any questions for the panel, we would love to take those. And yeah, there's lots of interesting discussions to be had today. So I'd like to introduce my wonderful, wonderful guests before we go any further. So we have the amazing West End performer and specialised cabaret performer, Wayne Douglas, a.k.a. Caravan Park. So big round of applause, please. Oh my God, this applause is amazing. It's going to sound great on the audio, isn't it? I love this. We also have podcast producer and writer Adam Smith. The incredible published author and owner of lots of memorabilia, which you'll be seeing this evening. I'm very excited about this, Darren. Darren Kay.
Thank you.
And actress, author, philanthropist, basically all-round amazing person, Jill Nalder. Yeah. Yeah. This is very exciting, I have to say. So I always do this before we start the show. You'll know this. Well, I think three of you will know this, actually, because I think I did it on yours as well, Jill, before. And you can't pick the same song, but I did this as a bit of an icebreaker. So if you had to pick a song right now to reflect your mood, what would your song be? And I'm going to start with you, Wayne, and it can't be Annie Lennox, Little Bird. Because you picked that last time.
Purple Rain.
Oh, okay. Bit of Prince, nice.
Yeah, because only because it's one of those things that for me is it never stops feeling fresh, and I love it. It's one of those songs that you can go for a long time not listening to it or thinking about it, and then you hear it again, and you think, oh my god, and then you hear it again, and it still has that same feeling. Every time I hear it, it's the same, but I love it. Yeah,
so fresh, lovely. Adam.
Well, we're going to talk about history, queer history. Mm. So the song that is in my head right now is It's All Coming Back to Me Now. That song.
How nice.
Celine.
Bit of Celine. Yeah. Lovely. That's a karaoke favourite.
I can perform it for you.
I can slam the door. That's the only bit I can contribute.
I have tried that one on karaoke, but I failed. It wasn't very good. Yeah, we won't talk about it. Darren.
I am going to go with We Could Be the One, Dani Minogue, because it's just getting so hot that I feel like I'm in a masseria. Oh. Yeah.
Have you kissed a boy?
I've kissed several boys. Yes. But I've never been to a masseria. Has anyone been to a masseria?
No.
Has anyone watched I Kissed a Boy?
Yes.
Did you watch it? Yeah. Yeah. I Kissed a Girl is coming next year, which is very good. Yeah. Amazing. What about you, Joe?
I'm going to go for fun, and I'm going to go for Meghan Trainor. It's All About the Bass.
Oh, mate. Love this. Love this. So today, well, thank you very much for all of that. We're talking about queer history today, and I guess it's a really important subject matter in itself. And I've had conversations with a few of you over the last kind of 12 months or so, and we've talked about queer history and the importance of it. But I think it'd be really great to share with the audience why you think it's important we're talking about queer history. So let's start with you, Wayne.
Why'd you got to start with me?
Because you're looking at me.
I'm not. So are the rest of the audience, but they're not being first. I think it's very important to know the history that where we come from and as a community and everything else, simply because so much has gone on in the past and so many people have sacrificed so many different things to be able to live the lives that we live now, that if we don't know our history, it's having a huge disrespect to the people who have sacrificed so much and have done so much for everybody just to be able to live a life. So I think it is really important that we know as a community where we're from, what we're going through, what we've been through, and how we can move forward and keep going and just get stronger. Because otherwise it is paying a huge respect to even people who have lost their lives just for loving the wrong person. And I think it is really important for that.
Absolutely. Anyone else? Anything to add?
Yeah, I would say that there's something really unique about queer history compared to other kinds of histories. Other kinds of histories are often written down or preserved in all sorts of different ways by institutions, by government, by museums. And there's just something about queer history that means that it won't be preserved and held by institutions or governments. And we are the ones who have to preserve it and keep it going. So, and that's for lots of reasons, because of it's first of all, it's personal stories, and that's often found in diaries and photo albums and things like that. And that history is just as important as anything that you can find in an official archive or something, as far as I'm concerned. And the second thing is that often because it's personal and because of the unique things about being queer is that often people destroy their own archives and they destroy their own histories, or they hide them from view for understandable reasons. And so it's just really important that we all need to share and keep sharing and keep preserving our histories, because no one else is necessarily going to do it for us.
Do you think it's about owning the narrative as well, so that we're telling our own stories rather than people telling stories in the wrong way? Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Me, so am I on?
You are.
Yeah, I think that's an amazing thing. I think you both have already said the thoughts that are in everybody's mind, but there's also just joy in like just having it as part of history, a normal conversation. So and so and so and so did something brilliant, and by the way, they were gay, or by the way, that was his partner, that was her partner, so that it just becomes part of everyday normal, in inverted commas, conversations where it hasn't sat. It's always been something that's been sort of kept a little bit secret. And so I think that's important. The more it gets out there, the more beautiful it is.
Yeah, I'd say I community curated with a bunch of other people the Queer the Peer exhibition. And I'd say that the item that gets, I think, the most warmth is a collection of photograph albums from a couple of lesbians called Tommy and Betty. And they were photographers in the war. And because of that, they understood photography. So they were able to take very candid photographs of their very normal everyday life. They're caravanning, they're drinking, et cetera, et cetera. And I think going back to Adam's point, because we tend to, historically, have not had those families to look after those albums. They were just in a house sale, and they would have actually, we talk about history being erased. Actually, this was going to be just dumped. I mean, there was no sort of like homophobia involved. They were just going to be chucked into the bin. But thankfully, James Gardner saw what they were, and so the collection is now been saved by Worthing Museum, which is fantastic. About 60 albums, photograph albums of lesbians. So, any lesbians in the audience, it's full of lesbians everywhere.
Amazing. Do you think there is a risk with the younger generation coming up not understanding or acknowledging queer history?
Oh, totally. I see it so much in the wherever I'm performing or whatever, and seeing younger people within the bars and the clubs. And you get a real mixed sort of demographic in places. And you have the older ones who are standing there having a great time, and things. But you will see the younger ones who are so full of themselves. I'm not saying all of them, so don't anybody jump down my throat with this, because I'm not. But you get some that are just looking at the older ones and just looking at them as if they're nothing, if they shouldn't be there. They're too old, you shouldn't be that. They haven't got the right trainers on, they haven't got the right haircut, they're not using the right cream on the face or whatever. And you can see this look going through them, and it's like, without this person here now, the person that you are looking down your nose at, you wouldn't be here. You wouldn't be able to walk down the streets here in Brighton holding your partner's hand or whatever. You wouldn't be able to do the things that you're doing. You sure as hell wouldn't be living the life that you're living now. And that I find unreal, that the younger ones need to know exactly what they've gone through and exactly what we've all gone through and what we will still and continue to go through. But they don't. They don't seem to think that it's important, because things are so much easier.
There's definitely a cyclical sort of process to it. And again, going back to the exhibition, one of the items that I really love is actually the Sussex Gay Liberation Front, standing outside the War Memorial in 1973, basically commemorating queer people who died in the war. And I always end on this particular photograph, because I think you're right. I think there is a younger generation, and even, community curators on the exhibition, they were not really aware of that kind of thing. And I'd end on that photograph, because there's a sort of a feeling of sort of strength and visibility in 1973. Had no idea what shit fest was coming around the corner. And actually, it's good to be able to end on that one and say, don't take for granted these rights, because there's always someone somewhere that wants to take them back again. So history is good in that sense, because it is cyclical. It goes round.
It's a good word. Yeah.
I mean,
and as people get older, as we all get older, then you appreciate history more. It's something about when you're young, you don't have the same head on you, and as you get older, you think more and more about where, societies have come from. And I think that, all those people that are young now will be getting older and appreciating it more as they get older. Because
I didn't do GCSE history. I gave up. You could choose. You could do your options in year 9, and you didn't have to carry on doing history if you didn't want to. And I didn't. I did geography and music and other choices. But I didn't do history because I was like, I'm not bothered.
It's certainly old, wouldn't have been taught queer history in
old
school.
Stuff. No.
But that's
it.
No, that's,
it wouldn't have been included.
And we'll come on to that in a bit. No, I've got a whole question
but
on that.
But that's, I mean, that's you know, you touch on that, you're saying you wouldn't be taught it in school. But it's like you just said about there's always someone who's ready to take that away from us, their rights or whatever. And you're right, there is. Because I remember when I was younger and stuff, we seemed to go in the right direction, and we seemed to have gained some momentum of where we were going as a community and some respect. And then all of a sudden, Clause 28 came in, and there's always someone who's there ready to take. We take two steps forward, one step back, and it's like, really? They just wanted to... Nah, it's wrong.
Clause 28 is something I definitely want to talk about today. And I think what I would say as well to everyone is that, you know, there is so much queer history that we could go through, but I think based on the panel tonight, I think I probably want to start beginning of the 80s, because I think that it's going to resonate with a lot of people in terms of the contributions you can all make. And, you know, there is so much, you know, information out there now about queer history, you know, that predates that. But I think that's going to be very topical for this conversation. So I guess for Darren and Wayne, and Adam, I don't know your age. I'm not going to ask you to reveal that, but I'm thinking we're probably of a similar age.
I'm 38.
I am too.
So I'm born in 84.
Yeah. So we would experience school, etc., the same. So I'm really interested from Darren and Wayne and Darren's perspective in terms of the early 80s, because I guess...
Well, first of all, it was illegal.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty underground.
So my first three boyfriends, I was breaking the law.
Yeah.
At the age of consent, you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess it was a pretty underground. I mean, if you know, we'll talk about It's a Sin in a bit, but you watch the programs or documentaries about that time. I guess it's very secretive. It's very much kind of, you know, keep yourself to yourself. Yeah. And then there was this mysterious virus and everything started to evolve. So what was it like for you both at that time to kind of
absolutely terrifying. Actually, as I said to you before, I think that gay men, I'm 56, so I think coming out in 1984 and 85, just as this chap here was very, very big in the world, Rock Hudson comes out as having an AIDS-related disease, and the homophobia, which already existed in the mining village that I grew up on, obviously went off the scale. And you have people saying, "Don't sit next to him; he's got AIDS." You know, it was that sort of that was the culture that we grew up in, and I think that kind of fear stays with you for forever and ever. I don't think even now in 2023, I feel that it's
trauma, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, and I think it's thanks to Jill and Russell T. Davis, bringing It's a Sin, I think people of my age, my generation, that finally feel that we can actually talk about it, that because we survived it, we can still talk about it. It is allowed. We have permission.
I think that's a very real thing. And here's Russell, who, brought that out there and wrote It's a Sin and brought it into the sort of mainstream of entertainment. And that I think, changed an awful lot of attitudes to HIV and AIDS. I really do think it, because what the feedback that has come to me and to Russell, he can't even believe it himself for how positive the feedback has been from all corners. And when It's a Sin won the NTA award, and Russell himself said that was what he was most proud of, because that was everybody, just the public, had voted for that award, the National Television Award, and that meant more to him because it was kind of an acceptance of the story in the country in general. And so I think that's moved forward, and people talk about it much more easily, and never saw that coming. Nobody saw that coming, I don't think.
I mean, when I came out, literally as AIDS hit, and it was publicised everywhere, and you know, you had the TV commercial of the tombstone, and it was something, and I was like, oh god, I couldn't have chosen a worse time for my family and my friends and everything else. I remember the first gay venue that I went to. I was brought up in Birmingham, and the first gay venue I went to was the old Nightingale Club. Not the one that is now, but it was round at the stage door of the Hippodrome Theatre. And it was literally just a door. That was it. You had to know that it was there, and it was a door with a little thing that opened. And you had to ring the bell, and the security would open the door and say, oh, yeah, look at you. And if they didn't think you were gay, there's no way on this earth they were going to open the door. And it was that kind of encased. It was unbelievable. And when it got really bad, the venue were actually making sure that nobody left alone. Nobody was allowed to leave. You had to leave in groups and you would go across and they would find out where you were going so you could all walk to the bus stop together and things like that. Because it was getting really dangerous. People were literally going out, finding, looking for groups that they could just, you know, attack. And that was scary. It really was scary because you didn't want to go out. You didn't want to do anything. You weren't allowed to be yourself. You didn't want to be yourself because you didn't know what was going to happen.
Do you feel like you were kind of both always looking over your shoulder? Like, obviously, you know who you were, but this kind of fear and secret and trying to
totally.
Conform.
I mean, completely. Yeah, I knew who I was, and there was nowhere on this earth. As a kid, I was actually quite political, and I was like, no, I don't want to go on CND marches and Greener Common and everything else. You know, I wanted to wave my banner the same as anybody else. And I knew who I was, and there was no way on this earth once I'd come out that I was going to go back in and not be the person that I wanted to be. But it was scary as hell. Really was. And it was just, it really wasn't a good time. To have things that go on now and to, like, it's a sin, is amazing to see it almost celebrated and to be allowed to actually talk about it. And it is amazing. I have had so many people who've watched this show and said that it was exaggerated, it was a dramatization, it was exaggerated. And it's like, nah, it wasn't. My friend who was a nurse at the time, he was like, no, this did happen when he was locked in a room on his own, that sort of thing. It's not exaggerated. This is real. It was as real. And so many other people, friends of mine who lived through it, we all went through it, had to watch it in little bits because it was too much sometimes. It brought back too many memories because it was so realistic for us.
What was that about? It's a sin. Being able to revisit it mentally was really cathartic because actually there was so much homophobia on the back of HIV and AIDS. The newspapers, they reveled in it, and it became something that just was so normalised. You got used to being hated by what seemingly was sort of everyone. And it was a bit like being bullied at school. You just got used to it. You just got used to it every day. And sort of, it was quite weird when you sort of, you get into the 90s and that's not happening. And you're sort of like thinking, oh my God,
it was one of those things you expect it and you're waiting for it. And when it doesn't happen, you're like, what the fuck's happened? Why are you slapping me?
I mean, Alf in the audience, he's got a historian, and he's got a footage of 1992 Gay Pride in Brighton, it's 94. And it's just interesting looking at it because there's virtually no one on either side of the pavement and everyone looks absolutely terrified. And I remember being on that march thinking, God, can we get to Preston Park? Can we get to Preston Park? It gradually it became, there was more people on the pavements than there were on the march. And that, you know, when I see that, my heart just lifts. It's just incredible.
Well, one of my friends that sadly did pass away and died from AIDS was from the Isle of Man. So try and find a gay pride march on the Isle of Man. I mean, that just didn't exist. You know, that was a really sort of, and it has changed. I do say that now. And they are making a huge difference there. And there's a lot of people working very hard. But that was a place that was so, you know, close. And to find that you were, well, to know that you were gay, because he always knew he was gay, but then to find out that he was HIV positive, or at the point where he was diagnosed, was told he had AIDS, then it was a complete fear.
How was that show for you? I mean, we can talk about it in a bit, but I think we may as well carry on with that conversation because it is just one of the most amazing shows. And so, unlike you, I guess I didn't experience the same trauma from that time because I was quite young. But I think one of the first things my parents said to me when I came out in 2004 was, I'm really worried you're going to get ill. You know, the trauma for people, I guess maybe uneducated views or just the propaganda, people didn't really understand what they were talking about. So it was almost like the thing to say. But how was that for you? Because I guess, we've talked before, but it was, you had to hold a lot of kind of stories and support for a lot of people. And, you know, you were an ally, but also someone that was really in the thick of it. So kind of making that show, did that kind of help you heal, or what was that like for you?
You know what? It's an ongoing journey with the shows, because it's just, it keeps happening. And there's stories coming out all the time. And I have had some beautiful comments sent to me personally and about it's a sin and everything. But I did have an experience with a young boy who was at an event. I was in Battersea at an event, and he came to me backstage very upset. 20, he said, I'm 20, and I've never been able to tell anyone that I'm HIV positive. And of course, he's obviously told his doctors because he was being treated, but he couldn't tell his friends at work. He couldn't tell anybody anything. And so I think that the whole it's a sin experience has, you know, it keeps on making a difference, and it keeps on doing different things. And it's hard to describe, I think, because it's not just me. It's nothing. It's not me. It's everybody that lived through it. It's everybody's stories. People, like you've just said yourself, you know, you relived it. You go back through it. People go back through it in their own way. They recall it. They get traumatized by the memory, or they find something beautiful in the memory, or they have a right laugh because there's nobody, you know. And I said this the other night, you know, you have gay men, no offense to anybody else, but gay men have a brilliant sense of humor on a lot of occasions, and you have fun. And so their boys were out there, and yes, you can't be open and yourself everywhere, but amongst your own, where you have a safe space, people had great humor, and I think that gave people courage and helped people. The gay men I know anyway, they had a brilliant sense of humor, and they took everything, you know, head on, really, and used humor to fight it.
But I think that's one of the things, though, is that you've just said they used humour to fight it. I think over the years, we have, as a community, we've had to deal with so much crap that all we can do is laugh and find the humour in everything, because if we don't, we'll just get so depressed and so bogged down. We have to find the humour and the fun in every single thing.
Well, yeah, I remember the first marches. It was 2, 4, 6, say, is that copper really straight? 3, 5, 7, 9, does his wife ring lesbian line?
Oh, I see.
I mean, it was, you know, we're here, we're queer, we're not going shopping. It was, there was a way of sort of camping, and this is sort of 1984, 85 gay marches before they were in big parks. And there was an awful lot of humour, and I think that sometimes when we talk about history, that we get sidelined and talk a lot about the politics and you know, obviously Clause 28 and AIDS are huge parts of our history, but I think sometimes we forget that
because
you know, gay people work in a lot of those industries where they are just bloody funny.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think we kind of have to find the humour in it. But I've got a question for you, because
this hasn't happened all season.
I know. Do you know what I mean? Hell, yeah, whatever. So, I mean, you're saying to us, you know, how was it reliving the show and everything else? But I'm very curious, because you're, you know, different generation. Well, to me you are. How did it seem to you? Because we saw it in one way, and for yourself, who are seeing it probably for the first time from reality point, how was that for you?
It was heartbreaking. And I think I binged 5 episodes. So I watched it all.
Oh, well done. Jeez.
So I literally, in one evening, was excited, fell in love, grieved, was upset, angry. There was just so many different facets to the whole show. And I thought it was beautifully portrayed. But I remember, like, really crying on the sofa. And the next day, my husband still hasn't watched it. And we were talking about it, and I was saying about it. And as I was talking about it, tears were literally just rolling down my eyes, because I felt a profound kind of sadness for that time, but also a deep, I guess, appreciation and respect as well. And I think that's what it did. It kind of made people wake up and say, actually, this happened, and people's lives were really affected. It wasn't just the propaganda or the false news stories. It was real people and real families. And I thought it was heartbreaking. What about you? Did you watch it all at once?
I didn't watch it all in once. I think that would have been really hard for me. But we're the same generation, as we've discovered, and we're that sort of like middle generation, where we came of age at a time where it was still very present and still dominant, HIV/AIDS I'm talking about.
But we were learning to live with it.
But people were living with it, and socially, culturally, we were learning to live with it. But there was still... things go in waves, don't they? And I think that the social attitudes were still massively lagging behind the clinical progress that had been made by the time that we came of age. So I'm kind of, but I just, I know I feel like this is the Russell T. Davies Appreciation Show, which is great, wonderful. But I was 15 when Queer as Folk was on the telly. So just perfect. I mean, I was Nathan Maloney's age. And I'm just, you know, sitting there watching that secretly and quietly in my bedroom.
But that was unbelievable.
A TV in my bedroom. Yeah. I know it was unbelievable.
One of the opening scenes, he's watching this guy rimming this guy. And you're like, the first time anything like that had even been possible.
No. Yeah.
We'd never seen it before.
I didn't know what rimming was.
I sat there watching
it. I was
like,
oh, that's a thing. You can lick someone's bumhole.
And now, look at you.
But now I'm a champion rimmer.
But do you know, every person... So we've had about 5 people talk about this on the
rimming.
Show. Not rimming, no.
Season 4.
The season 4, yeah, the rimming show. No, about Queer as Folk. And every person that's talked about it says, I secretly watched it in my bedroom with the volume down, black and white, you know.
I made videotapes. But I guess what I'm saying is that, like, I, you know, that was a sexual awakening for me. And I was 15, and it still took me actually 14 years to have sex after that. I didn't have sex until I was 29 and came out as gay then. So, you know, it was an awakening, but then I was sort of like still comatose for a long time. But so that was amazingly important, but still hanging over that whole period. And then the rest of it for me was also this fear of HIV and AIDS. And my parents said the same thing when I did, even when I did eventually come out, which would have been 2014 or something. You know, they were still worried about my sexual health, but not in a supportive, caring way, I think, in an ignorant way. And then I had done, but by the time It's a Sin came out, I had done quite a lot of work in queer history, but also specifically covering HIV AIDS in the Logbooks podcast, which is another podcast that I made.
Which is amazing.
and so I'd interviewed people who are your age and your generation and even other generations, people who were in their 70s. And I'd interviewed those elders and heard their stories. And then I'd like spent time like editing it all together and like making these episodes about this. So I felt like, and I'd read lots of books about it. So then I felt like, you know, quite up to scratch. I'd kind of been reckoning with this thing that I'd grown up in, this like this fog of it, and then through the work that I had done, it kind of became clearer. And then you see it dramatized in an artistic, creative way with characters who have emotions, and it just became even clearer for me. And it also kind of confirmed for me the work that I do and want to do and the reasons why and all of that stuff. And so yeah, that was my experience of it.
I think your work is so important because, you know, when I came out in 2004 when I was 19 and I'd had no sex education about, you know, gay life and literally just had no clue. So, you know, baby oil is not a lubricant, just want to point that out. But it's those things, and it's like, even, but I think the important stuff, sex education and sexual health. You know, we had wonderful Richard Angel on a few weeks ago from the Terence Higgins Trust, the CEO, and he was talking about PrEP and talking about the advancements that we're making with medication, and you know, by 2030, the goal is to have no new cases of HIV in the UK, which is just incredible. But they still get very little funding. You know,
I mean, yeah, I mean, you're saying that by 2030, having no new cases of HIV, that to us. I don't know about you, but to me, that's like, what? That it would be incredible. Of course, it would. Absolutely incredible. But there will always be somebody out there who just believes it's never going to happen to them.
He is that person, the Richard Angel. He's a person who inspires people and he makes you believe that that can happen because he is really sort of very proactive in that challenge. And it makes me think it is possible. It is possible.
I just really think it is. And I think that obviously there'll always be skeptics and people who are pessimistic or cynical or whatever, and fine. And
I'm skeptical or cynical about it. It's just that because we've lived with HIV for so many years, the idea of not
it's
having
almost
it,
beyond the imagination,
not being there is quite unbelievable.
It is. And it is unbelievable. But I also think that when it I think it is, clinically it is possible. Epidemiologically, socially, it's difficult, because the more we get closer to that goal, the harder it is to find the people that need to be diagnosed or on treatment. And in a way, that's where that is already where the challenge is. People like me, who are sexually active and aware of this, have much more likely to have, and also comfortable with my sexuality, are also much more likely to have a regular STI test, as I do every few months. Whereas the people who are straight, straight men, but who are fucking other men, can I say fuck?
Say whatever you want.
You already did.
Fucking bugger. People who are straight men but fucking other men, or from different kinds of communities, different kind of locations, it's harder to reach them. So it's kind of like a problem that gets harder and harder the closer you get to the end goal. But I also just think, and this is true not just of HIV but also other sexually transmitted infections, that we have to inhabit this space of belief and hope that it's possible to eradicate them all, because we're in this weird period where we're like talking about how AI is gonna completely revolutionize so many jobs, positive or negative, jobs and lifestyles and everything. We can imagine so much amazing things. Apple's just brought out this like weird VR thing that means you can like do a minority report stuff. And yet you say to someone, but oh, you know, what about eradicating STIs? And they're like going like, oh, I don't know, really, I'm not sure about that. Which I know is not what you're saying. Yeah. And I'm like, bloody hell, we're gonna put a moon base on. They're talking about putting a moon base on. Like, why can't we imagine the eradication of this? And the reason why people are skeptical about it is because they know that it's all that the challenge is about eradicating shame and ignorance, and that's the hard thing. But that's why we have to keep going. Mm-hmm. It's not just a scientific problem; it's a social and cultural problem.
I think Richard said there was the number, I don't want to quote the number, but a few thousand people in the UK who had undiagnosed HIV. And I think there was a situation a few months ago where there was a lady who lost her life, and it was a textbook situation. Like, she had all of the symptoms, but because she was a woman, she wasn't asked the right questions when she had her clinical assessment, either a doctor or a sexual health clinic or somewhere. And she had all of the symptoms, and then she finally had an HIV test and died 2 days later. So, well, it's like we have to also change the narrative about how we talk about sexual health.
Right, and there's a trial happening right now which will be running for a couple of years, which is it's a trial that's happening in a small number of hospitals, because it's a trial, so that anyone who comes into A&E with whatever problem, if they get bloods done, then they also test for HIV.
It's even
if
here.
There's no, it's in Brighton, is it? And they've published some preliminary results, and they found that they are finding new diagnoses that way. And the point is that person didn't present into the hospital with anything that would lead you to think that they might be HIV positive, but they're just being tested anyway. And the reason why that's been blocked for so long is just because clinical staff are scared about, understandably scared about telling a person, oh, we're just going to test you for HIV as well, because people are like, well, it's got nothing to do with me, you know, like, scared about that, and patients are worried about it. But of course it makes sense, and they've already found enough cases that they know that this will be a significant, a big tool in reaching that goal, a big help in reaching that goal by finding those undiagnosed cases from people that don't present to hospitals with any symptoms yet and that don't test regularly. And I'm sure that the trial will find that, yes, this is a sensible thing to do. In the long term for the NHS, it's way more cost effective to have an early diagnosis, get people on treatment. And then, of course, for the individual concerned, people need to be on treatment. And their life expectancy is fine and great.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack
for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Right,
and also they don't, you know, you equals you, so
yeah. Exactly. Get them on treatment. Get them undetectable.
Don't spread it. I loved what when we chatted last year, and you talked about, you know, the comparison of diabetes and HIV and medication and insulin, and you know, it's like the stigma we have around HIV, the label, but actually we wouldn't think twice about diabetes.
That's right. So people get as again, it's about normalizing. It's about normalizing, getting tested. It's hard because people are nervous. People are nervous to find out that they have something that's in a way going to alter how they feel about themselves. So, you know, and from friends of mine that you then get used to the idea you're on treatment, you're undetectable. It's part and parcel of solving the problem, really.
The difference is now to when people were first diagnosed with HIV. And it wasn't HIV then, it was AIDS. Yeah. You didn't have HIV. Yeah. Is that it's no longer a death sentence. The moment you were diagnosed years ago, that was it. You knew there was absolutely no hope, but the advancements in treatments and everything else has been incredible, absolutely incredible, and it is no longer a death sentence, which is, you know, thank God. But before, it was no. And that, I think that some people still have that in their mind of like, I don't want to know if I'm going to die. Do you know what I mean? It's like if somebody asked you, I know which day you're going to die, do you want to know? What would you do? I wouldn't want to know. I really wouldn't, because then you live your life through it's scared every single day of your life.
Well, there's, you know, lots of questions about that very famous AIDS campaign. You know, one of the questions that comes up actually in the logbooks with some of the people that you interviewed, saying, did it go too far? Did it create a fear that actually was so long lasting that it's permeated generation after generation? That people, you know, was it a little bit over the top? And it's a really difficult one to actually sort of consider, because the information delivery was so different then. I mean, it's really fascinating. Just to go sidetrack, is that I pulled out this album from my attic, which is Red Hot and Blue, which you will remember was an AIDS benefit album. And what's really fascinating is that this is, you know, pre the internet. This is pre mobile phones. There's no record in there. I took the records out. Is information about HIV and AIDS. So this is one of the few ways that these organisations could disseminate information about AIDS. That I brought this one in because inside this cover is, and this is amazing, this is the Age of Consent, Bronski Beat, fantastic album.
Oh, I remember
album.
This.
And I remember there being a list of all the Age of Consents in all the countries in all the world. And in my head, I thought this was a huge sheet. And when I was looking for it, I was going, oh, maybe I imagined it. And it is actually there. It's there. It's the tiniest bit of copy with all the Age of Consent. And this was a way of getting this bit of information to kids, 14-year-old little gay boys in mining villages in Yorkshire, were finally be able to realise that how, you know, the discrimination against us. And I've got the talking stick. The way that really I feel like two minds about that AIDS campaign is because I think I was of the view, and sort of afterwards, it was an awful lot of money spent producing leaflets to send to people who had very little chance of ever coming into contact with HIV. But actually, unbeknown to the government at the time, they put in gay switchboard's telephone number, didn't they? And I don't think even members, people who put it together knew that. So basically, the Thatcher government in the 80s managed to put gay switchboard's telephone number into the letterbox of every single... And I just think, oh my God, what a fantastic own goal.
Well, it was great, but it also broke the phone lines. It really did. I mean, switchboard in those days had a running problem with its phone lines. Just technically, there was just problems with it. That if you if you read the logbooks of the volunteers, as I've done for the making the podcast, there's like for years and years, but a lot of the logbook entries where volunteers are like reporting on what's happened on their shift so that the volunteers on the next shift can just follow what's been going on, as well as the subjects and the questions that have been coming up on the call so they can all continue to be aware. In addition to things like, you know, Barry from Birmingham rang again, he's been kicked out of home for being gay again. You've also got things like, can someone please bring fresh tea bags because we've got none? And then you've also got this running commentary of how bad the phone lines are and how hard it is to get BT engineers to come and fix the phone lines. And then in 1987, when the number was, as you say, printed and went to 13 million households in the UK, they were inundated with phone calls, and a lot of them were what the volunteers called from the worried well, which was predominantly people who were not at risk of HIV at all. And they were confused about this leaflet and about the campaigns that they'd seen and what they'd been reading in the newspaper, because it was like mostly horror and bullshit. And they were calling Switchboard for help, but Switchboard had to take those calls and it had to explain to people, like, again, like what this is and what's happening and if you know anybody and this is what to do and all of that stuff.
Tell the story about the BT engineers that wouldn't come round.
Well, you just did. There you go. I mean, that was another thing. Sorry.
There's more to it than
that's
that.
That's what, I mean, yeah, they, so the actually, they, the, you know, they would try and get the BT engineers to come round. There was an appointment one day where some BT engineers were coming around to fix the phone lines. And when they arrived at the building, and Switchboard back then didn't have a sign on the door. Obviously, you couldn't... It was just a phone line. You can't go to the office as a person asking for help. The office was for volunteers. And they didn't have a sign on the door because they often had death threats and bombs and stuff. But when the engineers realized what the business, the charity that they were going to visit was, they refused to enter the building because they thought that just working on the phone lines and that they were at risk of HIV, because that's the level of ignorance that they had.
But that you say about level of ignorance, it is unbelievable, because...
And prejudice.
Yeah, totally, absolutely. We, as a community, we weren't told anything about how to prevent AIDS or HIV or anything else when it all came out. We weren't told anything. We had no information. We had nothing. And as a community, we kind of had to teach ourselves. We had to learn ourselves on how to do it and what was going to happen and how to deal with it. And we did. The Terence Higgins Trust and everybody else, it did. To a point when the new cases of HIV were actually with heterosexuals. Because they didn't believe, they still didn't believe for some reason that they could actually get it. They still kind of saw it. The words, I used this the other day actually talking to somebody else, that it was called a gay plague. And those words just, you know, like, what, really? And there are still some people out there who do believe that it's still a gay disease.
Well, talking about that ignorance, it just reminded me of Paul O'Grady when the police came to do the raid on the Vauxhall Tavern. A lot of people saw that. And they came in with the rubber gloves on and Paul O'Grady said, "Oh, it's great, someone's come to do the washing up."
I just remembered maybe the other story that you're thinking of with Switchboard as well is a camera crew came to film volunteers at work at Switchboard. And they came in and put all of their like expensive camera equipment down and then was talking about what they were going to be doing. And they, it was like for a daytime TV show. And they, when they realized that it was a you know, then they would, back then they would have said a gay and lesbian organization. The cameramen like left, the camera operators left and refused to do it. And the volunteer at the time who was kind of handling it, because she was the media person, is the legend that is Lisa Power. And she said, right, well, I'm keeping your cameras until you come back and do this job. I'm going to hold on to them. But going back to our theme of history and why it's important, because we've been like just occupying this particular moment in the mid to late 80s right now. And you're talking about how we as a community had to come together and learn how to deal with this and share information, support and care for each other. What happened last summer with Mpox was really quite incredible because, and we wouldn't, it, we would still be, Mpox is still out there, it's not eradicated, but we would be in a completely different situation right now, this summer, yeah, with Mpox after a year of it, if it hadn't have been for HIV, AIDS, and everything that we as a community had learned, that that clinicians had learned, and that the various amazing organizations and charities and community groups that work at the local level and the national level, if they had not come together and learned the they'd been practicing these lessons for years about testing and about how to lobby government and about how to do education that doesn't shame people for having the sex that they're going to be having anyway, and just making sure that there's provision for them to get tested or to get treatment and everything like that. And Mpox feels in a weird way at the moment, like this summer, you know, it just feels like, oh my God, I keep thinking, did that happen? Because I remember visiting friends who were sick last summer, and I remember having this like weird like ghost whiplash effect, as if I had been in that maelstrom in the mid 80s like you all were. And I remember, because I'd heard enough of these stories, and I remember having this weird whiplash, which wasn't my own whiplash because I hadn't experienced it, but I remember like seeing my friends being sick and thinking, shit, this is awful. And then gradually we dealt with it and we worked with it and we got a vaccine rollout and everything like that. And then it's faded. And as I said, it's not gone away completely, but that wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, COVID, I mean, obviously that was a very tricky time. And again, normal life has resumed, you know, you kind of forget that actually it was a bit of a shitstorm for 2 years. So, you know, did that bring back memories of that time as well? Because I can only imagine it was...
So many similarities. One of a more funny one, I remember in the 80s, you couldn't move for rubber. Rubber was everywhere. And you would go into a gay bar and there would be bowls of rubbers and rubbers. You would open a magazine and 300 rubbers would fall out. And there were posters in the back of every toilet telling you to put a hat on it. I mean, rubbers, rubbers, rubbers. And actually to the point that actually STDs generally in gay men dropped through the floor because everyone was covered in rubber. And just about 2 days after lockdown, my housemate, who was actually here, put a message on the inside of our door which said, clean your hands, you filthy bitches. And I just thought, oh my God, this is like, this is we're actually reminder. Using the same kind of paraphernalia to remind us to protect ourselves.
Yeah, the whole COVID thing was very strange. It did feel like it was something... you know, reliving everything again. But then monkeypox as well, because my dearest friend contracted it and was actually really, really ill. Really ill. To the point I got really worried about him. He couldn't lift his head up off the pillow. He did no energy, no nothing. And it was like revisiting memories of friends who were ill from HIV or AIDS. And that was horrible. That was really horrible. I mean, it was one of those things of, you know, I couldn't touch you because it, you know, spread through contact and things like that. And when I got a phone call from the hospital telling me that I'd come into contact with someone with monkeypox, I was like, excuse me, what? And I had to go and was vaccinated and it was fine. But watching somebody go through that again, it was like reliving it all over again. And it was like, please, this can't happen. This really can't happen. Luckily, it hasn't. But there was a point where it was scary and thinking this could literally just take over again.
But also the climate has changed so dramatically. I mean, I just remember, and you remember this, it was day in, day out. It wasn't enough that people were you know, terrible constant illnesses, but were blamed for it. Yeah. Mm. And, you know, you would only have to have a newspaper and it was just, you were basically told that you deserved it. Mm. And you kind of day in, day out, you would believe that.
And I think
this time
thing,
there yeah. wasn't that sort of, they did.
No, no,
you saw the odd sort of article and it was a bit like, you know, making that connection with a gay man, but there wasn't the kind of vitriol and the real sort of.
No, but I think what was different with AIDS when that started is that everybody assumed that just because you were gay, you had it. That was it. It was like it came, you know, part and parcel. The moment you came out, you got AIDS. That was it. It didn't matter what you were doing or how you were living your life. You had AIDS.
And that was a big stigma. Yeah. And that you reminded me when you're saying about the rubbers, is that whoever fathomed what dry kissing was.
Yes.
Because they said you can't kiss, you must only dry kiss. So anyone hands up who's worked that out. Nobody ever knew what that was. So there were some very strange.
I can see everyone's brains going.
Like that.
What? Do you know what I kind of get from the time though? And again, there's so much more to talk about, but I think a real sense of community. And I think that what you're all saying is that it was a really tough time, but actually community really pulled together. Would you all agree with that?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it was one of those things where you felt for the first time, personally anyway, I felt like I actually belonged to something, that there was some other people out there who understood, who got me and was there for the first time. And it was a shame that it actually took all of that was going on to make me feel like that.
It pushed us too far. Yeah. Yeah. You don't want to mess with an angry.
Oh, hell no. Oh, no.
No, well, I remember they just got into the Keep, which is the Sussex Archive, which is that huge concrete building up near the university. They have some gay magazines written by gay men and women in Brighton from the 70s and 80s. But it's really fascinating when you read the letters pages, and they've all been printed off on these gestetners, you know, it's all like those wax reels that used to sort of print off 6 or 7 copies at a time. And there's no, the dialogue between the lesbians and the gay men, it's almost like he said, she said, she said, oh, and she said, and it's all. And then suddenly, by about sort of 1985, they start to sort of come together. And it is ironic that it actually took this to really bring people together and, you know, go on marches about it.
Do we bring up the chestnut of Section 28 and Thatcher? Because I guess that is another pivotal moment in that time, isn't it? And I guess on the back of, you know, the AIDS and HIV epidemic, and then you've got, you know, that statement at that Conservative Party conference, and that then affected schooling for so many and education. And I mean it does.
I mean, personally, and this is what you can say, I'm exaggerating or being dramatic, I don't give a shit, but personally, I don't like talking about that woman because she destroyed so much for so many people. I had come from a mining village and what she did and everything else and Clause 28 and the whole thing. If you want me to be furious and start stomping around this stage, then let's do it. But it was unbelievable.
There is that brilliant scene in It's a Sin where he's looking, where
in the library,
he's
looking
in the library.
Oh, incredible.
It's a brilliant scene. And
absolutely,
he's just said, there's nothing. There is nothing. I can't even find a reference to. And that is a huge omission of our society as a whole. I mean, that's really
it
quite
is. I mean,
incredible.
The thing is that Clause 28 was ludicrous. It was so ludicrous that not even, you know, not only could being homosexual not be talked about or anything else, not even a mention of it, but any writer or painter or anything else that was gay, their work wasn't allowed to be discussed, taught, anything. So you had all these incredible works just thrown out, and that was it, done. Never to be, you know, and it was just absolutely insane. And he's like, that's not publicizing homosexuality. That's just getting rid of culture.
Yeah, that's why there's so much to be discovered, I think. That's why there's so much out there. And when you watch them, like Gentleman Jack, for instance, that was a real, like, an amazing eye-opener for a TV series that people... What never ceases to amaze me is that people did lead very full gay lives in complete secret, and many, many years before we were born. many years, like right, you know, right back in the Victorian times, right back. And I can't speak of cases that I know, but it's fascinating and an amazing stories out there when you read about stuff like that.
You see some photographs of, you know, like from Victorian era and things like that, you know, sepia photographs and the whole thing. And, you know, it's two men kissing and stuff. And you go, this is incredible to see these two men who at the time, because it was so secretive, would have probably been so much in love with each other to actually take the risks of having a picture taken. I love seeing those pictures because it's beautiful to see.
Since we're breaking the rule of time, because we're going further back in time than 1980.
Sorry.
Because Jill's taken us to the Victorian era.
I am the oldest up here.
No, I love it. I love a hot daddy Victorian with a beard and a top hat. But what if you do go back a lot further, you start to see the cycles. So if we think about Section 28 coming in 1988, but being debated in Parliament in 1987, at that time of that tsunami of hatred in the press stirred up by the responses to HIV/AIDS, you see, you know, powerful people, elite people who are trying to clamp down on people living their free lives and living their truth, as the Californians say. And then that is a wave that happens, that comes up. It's this cycle that you mentioned earlier. And so going even further, you know, yes, you talked about it in the Victorian time. And then I'm obsessed with the 1920s and the 1930s and that shift that just happened. Well, it wasn't just, it was gradual, but it, looking back, it seems like it just happened. You know, we talk about the roaring 20s in places like Berlin and London and New York, and you know, freewheeling sexual culture, gender fuckery, people living in all sorts of combinations of relationships and with different kinds of gender expressions, and it's amazing. And then the development of art at the time, especially cinema, which is something that really kind of fascinates me, how there was this new technology that had become big enough by the late 20s that it was an industry, the film industry, and there was a new technology on being added, which was sound, that was going to revolutionize what cinema could be. And there were lots of different kinds of filmmakers and artists experimenting with what cinema could be. There's you know, the amazing work from like 1919, showing like a gay relationship in a film in Berlin, sympathetically on the side of the gay man that gets blackmailed for being gay. And then through the 20s, you have these silent movies where you've got like different kinds of characters. Pandora's Box has the most famous lesbian dance scene. And you know, they're really experimenting with all of this. And then the combination of censors in London who are politically motivated because they think cinema is this thing for the masses, and basically this is going to incite some kind of revolution if, like, the working class see all these different kinds of representations. And in America, you've got Catholics who are taking over the film industry, being motivated by their religion. And then in Germany, you've got the fascists taking over. So 29, 30, 31, 32... what is possible within art, what is possible to be represented, the variousness of our lives and our bodies gets cut down. And the Nazis literally take films, important films, which were popular, and they literally burn them in those fires. And so you see this cycle going over and over again when you go further back, and then you also, we're having it right now. We're in a cycle. We're in that cycle right now. We're in the, I hope it's the depths of it, but I fear that we are still going to go deeper into this backlash, into the people who are clamping down on the freedoms. And right now we know it's our trans siblings and our non-binary siblings that are bearing the brunt of it. So again, thinking about our history, that's why it's important, because you can just see this for what it is. And I think that can get us through it when we're in the middle of it, because we've seen it and we know that we've fought back before and we can again.
Yeah, it's like you push us too far and we will fight back. And that has been the cycle of queer history.
That's something that I think as a community we've done for years and years, and I think we will continue to, and we will always do it, is that we don't have anybody else. We only have each other. So the only way we're going to get through it is with each other.
But what I would say is that, again, very triggering in the logbooks thing was the footage of the gay riot, as it was called in the newspapers at the time, outside the Houses of Parliament. And there was three chaps. Ralph was one of them, and I was working with Stonewall at the time, and I can't remember the other two guys' name. But basically, they took the government to court and et cetera, et cetera. And I remember being outside the Houses of Parliament, and one of them comes out and screams something like, "They fucking..." Yeah. "Fucked us over," or something like that, because they reduced it to 16, not 18. And sorry, I do have a point ultimately. And I think what was really interesting about this is going back to your point about only having ourselves. I think what happened in my circle of friends at that riot, where we lost getting the age of consent down to 16, that we all had a discussion afterwards in someone's flat and said, "If you've not come out to your parents, you've got to do it now." And actually, I think it actually did trigger a lot of young people coming out to their parents, and I think once the parents were on board, that did change a lot of people, you know, because a lot of people would have been very surprised at their parents that their kids were gay.
We are, like, there is so much to talk about, but I'm really conscious of time as well, so I'm so sorry, I'm gonna have to kind of move it on. So I you know, I was thinking about all the things that I guess has happened over the recent kind of 20 years or so. Great progress has been made. So Section 28 was eradicated, equal legal age of consent, civil partnerships, equal marriage, adoption rights. You've mentioned, you know, our trans siblings are having the tough time at the moment. What else do we need to do to keep evolving the history? I mean, these conversations are incredibly important. And I think that, you know, with programs like It's a Sin or the great literature out there and podcasts, we get to attract new audiences that maybe won't be aware of this kind of stuff that we're talking about. But how do we keep evolving that conversation?
I think the only way we can do it is just to constantly keep talking about it and making sure that we do stand up, not just for ourselves, but for every other member of our community. It's like our trans siblings and everything else. I will be one of the first people standing up there and going, no, we have to do this. Just because it doesn't affect our lives personally doesn't mean to say that we can't do something about it. We have to stick together on it.
But we also need to do it in a way that is interesting to a wider community.
That doesn't look like it's just people standing up shouting.
I think that we sat here today after anyone who watches RuPaul, the latest series, the big event on Saturday was Joan Crawford, the Rusical, the unofficial Rusical. And it was really revealing because obviously a lot of the queens in there, they're not that familiar with Mommy Dearest, but actually this is a very famous film, if anyone's never seen it, about Joan Crawford, and she basically left her daughter nothing in the will, and her daughter's revenge was to write this warts and all film about her. And this is one of the most quotable, I think, films in the queer community. And I think what is interesting about that is that RuPaul, I think, has been quite subversive, and I think actually quite sort of political, but in a very amusing way. And I think that, you know, that is one of the ways that actually we can keep our history alive and actually make it more interesting to new generations of people. You know, sadly, not everyone is like me that likes wandering around museums and looking into dusty cabinets.
But pull them in as you can, I guess. It's really important to do that. Absolutely. Before the interval, want to shout out. So we've got three incredible books for sale tonight. I'm going to be your bookseller as well. So we have Love from the Pink Palace by Jill. We've got Brightonians by Darren. And we have Deep Sniff, History of Poppers and Queer Futures.
We haven't even talked about poppers yet, have we?
No.
We're going to run out of time. Come see me at the break. Oh, we've got two hands there at least.
But Adam, I'd love it if you could give a shout out about your book and tell us about that. And then Darren's going to do a reading before we move forward with the interval. So can you tell us about your book?
Yeah, my book is Deep Sniff. It is a history of poppers, which goes back to 1844 when the substance amyl nitrite was first synthesized, and a really special, amazing moment in 1867 when it was first given to a medical patient to help with his angina. And it also did other things. And that happened to occur just also at the same moment that a lawyer in Germany, my boyfriend, Karl Heinrich Ulrich, gay rights pioneer, stood up in front of an audience of lawyers and legal and academics and legal professionals as a lawyer himself and said, I'm gay and the law here against sodomy is wrong and we need to change that. And perhaps that was the first time anyone publicly came out on and said that on a forum like that. And that's got nothing to do with the history of Popper's, the actual thing. It's just it happened at the same moment in 1867. So there's a kind of improbable connection there in that particular history, in that particular moment. And so the book goes kind of from that moment all the way through to the 1970s and how Popper's became like a product as part of and specifically marketed at gay men in San Francisco and London with brand names and, you know, amazingly inventive masculine brand names like Fist and Iron Horse and XXX, stuff like that, very clever marketing. And how it kind of created the idea of like a perfect gay man who was like virile and strong because he sniffed poppers and because of the artwork that they used in the adverts. And then it goes through to the stories of the 80s and how Poppers was actually fingered, as it were, as a cause of HIV/AIDS by people that wanted that to be the case because it would help continue to point the blame at gay people, gay men, all the way through the 80s and then all the way up through to like modern day and people sniffing Poppers in Zoom calls and wanking with each other.
Amazing. So I was just worried we were going to get the hand dryer in on the audio, but hopefully we won't. Thank you for that. That's incredible. The book is on sale today, so we'll be selling copies very, very shortly, but thank you for that. And we also have a reading from Darren. Now, Darren, I'm very excited about this because this is your brand new book, which
this
isn't even out yet.
It's brand new, but this is a sequel to The Brightonians, so it's probably not coming out till November, so you've got plenty of time to read The Brightonians if you're a slow reader. So this is called Brightonians Under Siege, and it starts in January 2020, just a few months before COVID. And it starts with a fortune teller called Pagan Pete, who has a reading that he hasn't had since 1984, when he started to hear about something called the gay plague. So he's absolutely terrified that coronavirus is going to be like AIDS. And so the novel really is it's a satirical novel about the way that the world responded to COVID compared to how terribly it responded to HIV and AIDS. And in the excerpt that I've chosen, because it's all about history, I've chosen an excerpt, which is pumped full of queer history. And there are two characters that you'll meet in this. The first of them is George, who's one of the main characters. George, a.k.a. Bet Your Sweet Ass, who is a 73-year-old drag queen. So obviously not based at all on Cara, who's 21 in a day. And George has had a very checkered past. In the 60s, he was a teenage porn star, and that's covered in the first novel. He was a member of the Gay Liberation Front. He was then involved in the fight against AIDS and HIV and Clause 28. And so he is the font of knowledge, and he is the reason why the other character is visiting him this day. She is called Isabel Pitt, and she's a museum curator, and she's writing a history of Brighton's rich queer heritage. So George is the font of all knowledge on this. So she goes around there the day before lockdown. So this is like the 22nd of March, and she's got two reasons she's going around. One of them is to return a yellow handkerchief, which will become clear in a second. And the other reason that she's going around there is to learn more about these outrageous gay discos, which happened in the late 70s, early 80s at a fruit farm in Headcorn, Kent, called Hazel Pits. And there's something else that she's also going to find out about, which is a group of motorcycle fetishists called the Sussex Lancers. And both these genuinely exist. And I know this because Alf LaFloic is the world expert on the Sussex Lancers and also the gay discos in this fruit farm in a barn in Kent. And so if you want to learn more about those, then do go to Alf LaFloic's website because it's absolutely fascinating. And there is another piece of history that you will also be aware of already, so I won't go into. There was one tiny little bit of information you need, context, is Isabel Pitt is mid-50s. She's very tall and willowy. And her arch enemy in the novel, Cameron, describes her as behind her back as bottomless pit. nudging up as close to the old man as she felt she could, given the reason for the impending lockdown. In the next half an hour or so, Izzy was introduced to the Studio 54 party at Hazel Pitts. Of course, with a little help, she recognised George. But who was the gorgeous blonde hunk who appeared frequently throughout the album in various guises? After the Andy Warhol get-up, he popped up as some sort of naval officer at what George remembered as the Titanic party, another infamous themed night at Hazel Pitts that was made even more memorable by the arrival of a terrific thunderstorm, which apparently caused mayhem in the designated dark room when the usual pitch-black anonymity was interrupted every few seconds with bright flashes of lightning. Oh yes, red cheeks all round that night, I can tell you, said George, giggling at the memory and turning to a spread featuring a group of men dressed in leather biker gear. Oh, let me guess, darling. Greece or maybe the Wild Ones, suggested Izzy, assuming the photographs of the men in the peaked caps, adorned with chains and studs, had been taken at another of those outrageous costume parties in Kent. Good no, dear, replied George. That's a meeting of the Sussex Lancers, a motorcycle fetish club. Men who liked bikes, or rather men who liked to dress like they liked bikes. I don't remember many of them actually owning a bike. Oh, exclaimed Izzy. But before she had time to digest this new information, fuck, cried the old man. What? Shrieked Izzy, assuming George had spotted something disturbing. FUKC, the Federation of UK Clubs, explained George, tugging a piece of paper out from beneath the album's plastic sheeting and waving it in front of her. It's what they used to put on their flyers and posters. The Lancers were just one of several affiliated clubs that exist across the country. Oh, I see, replied Izzy, before returning her gaze to the photographs. Oh, God, I'd forgotten all about those chaps, said George, taking a closer look at a photo he'd removed from the plastic film. Who? Said Izzy, expecting to be introduced to a couple of Sussex Lancers. Not who, dear, chaps. Bottomless trousers, said George, handing her the photograph for inspection. Thrown a little by the word bottomless, a phrase forever associated with the cruel nickname she knew that Cameron called her behind her back, the pert posteriors at which she was now staring did wonders to take her mind off the insult. Ah, I see. Like what cowboys used to wear, darling, she suggested. Yes, though without the leather jock straps, I expect, added George. Indeed, agreed Izzy, trying to think about how she could move the conversation on. But before an appropriate opportunity presented itself, she spotted something in the photo that stopped her in her tracks, the mustard-coloured handkerchief she'd just handed back to George. More than that, she recognised the man in whose back pocket it was shoved. It was the handsome blonde again. Oh my goodness, she said. Is that your handkerchief? Yes, it is. Of course, back then it belonged to this fella here, a Danish friend of mine called Odie Olafsson, short for Odin, said George, stroking the man's face. But it wasn't just a hanky. It was a sort of code, letting people know what sort of sex you were into. We used to call it flagging. There were loads of different colours, continued George, as Izzy scanned the photo, and it made a difference which pocket you wore it in too. FUKC, chaps, colour-coded erotic semiotics. It seemed to Izzy that George was speaking another language. Eager to learn more, she edged closer to the old man. I'm pretty sure that black meant you were into S&M, and light blue that you liked oral, he continued, pointing to the behinds of two men stood close to Odie, and of course red and yellow were very kinky. How fascinating, said Izzy warily, not sure whether her nerves could cope with whatever these colours might have denoted. She quickly decided it would be best to shift the focus to the one in the pocket of the handsome blonde. And what about mustard? Odie's handkerchief. Well, said George, his cheeky grin causing deep ridges to appear in his old cheeks. In the right pocket, it means you want a big one. And in the left, it means you've got one to give. Feeling her own cheeks starting to redden, she decided not to pursue this line of chat any further. Thank you.
Amazing. Thank you, Darren. Thank you so much. So we're going to take a break. I'm going to sell some books and please come and buy some because we'd like to sell them all tonight. And yeah, we'll take a break and then we'll come back for an audience Q&A. So thank you all very, very much. Big round of applause for my guests.
The conversation doesn't stop here. Check out the next part of this podcast episode on your streaming platform. You will not be disappointed. I really hope you enjoyed the show. A big thank you once again to all my guests. Please share the podcast, give it a 5-star review if you'd like, and leave any comments you may have. You can also follow me on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok for all the latest updates on Queer I Am the podcast. Also, check out my website, www.fluiactually.com. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.